Thanks for coming. Great to see you. And thanks to Madeline and Heather. Fantastic. Beautiful. What I thought I would do is start by reading a few new ones and then read some from the book that I don't normally read. This first one is called White Mud. There is litter in these final streets before the river, fraying rows of popped button houses. I smell angels raking, torching dried leaves, scraping sooty toast in kitchenette windows. I can never pilgrim down here on foot on October evenings without smelling the many burnings of the past. A drunken night where we pelted each other with handfuls of whipped cream, white mud. Then the host and his girlfriend took off to clean each other in the reservoir. I tilted toward the back porch, kegs squat like a Buddha in its inflatable children's pool of ice. I saw double moths sizzle the bug light. I was still there when the boy came back, carrying the towel-shrouded girl who'd tried drowning. She spluttered for a cigarette, slapped away our hugs, drying leaves wreathed in the nimbus of her hair. So that was actually like the first adult keg college party that I ever went to when I was like 18 and I first moved out to Oakland. And it was, part of me was like, this is insane and these people are crazy. And then, but then the other part of me was like, this is the most real, raw thing that I have ever experienced in my relatively sheltered childhood. More real than anything that was going on in the fucking classroom. And it just seduced me away to of misspent youth. Of it's actually very few of the other parties had exciting things like that happen, but you know, you keep searching for. This next poem takes place on a really like hot, muggy, humid summer day in downtown Pittsburgh. Too many adjectives there? I don't know. It's called Thirst. Here there is always thirst, sultry and exclusive like a blues club, more than can ever be confessed. Confessing would just make us more thirsty, rusty words cutting our tongues, words rubbed like burps from babies' tummies. But those babies are already mummies, strung with frizzled cobweb candy. And once I was walking down this street, guzzling a Stop Shop tumbler of soda, sucking deep growls of cold fizz through the straw, when I heard a passing lady beg her friends, please, let's get something to drink. I'm dying. Okay. And this is called Salt Water. We can change our original forms, alter our aims, like the handsome ship itself, through various indifferent guises. We can change, like the man yelled at by his boss for nothing, who kicks open the front door, yells at the dog, yells at the wife, passing it on like dews. In gray come on of night, a teacher recalls the sight of a reef of children bawling at Tusker light, not because of anything particular, and their chorus nearly stoned the fog that night. This book is written in salt water. It is written in my youth, which is called ambivalence, as if to brag about some disastrous loss. The stoker, exhausted lookout, earn their gold for me, a hand of ash, a mouth full of mold, in front of those on whom I felt dependent. From these and other things, my songs make themselves. So that was actually, I'll tell you how I wrote that. That was actually originated as a William Burroughs style cut up with pages from an old time book of sea shanties and a 1950s textbook on abnormal psychology. So I just cut them into squares and kind of like rearranged them and read these lines across. And the ones that worked, I kind of kept in it. And, you know, the ones that didn't, I didn't. Okay. So let's see if we can't read something now that might make Rick Santorum throw up. Not necessarily a full hurl, just a little bit in his mouth, you know, so that he can remain, you know, so that he can remain, you know, dainty and demure, because we know that's important. This is called My Flag. I do not expect anyone to stand and salute my flag. It's just a sheet with cum stains, something to wrap our naked bodies after love. Yet I will call it my flag, sick unto death of the warfare outside this bedroom and all around us, the murdered, murdering armies, sick of what this world mistakes for sacred. And then we are saluting, after all, with our cocks, those two involuntary volunteers. Okay, let's turn to the book. Professional Weepers. Let me just say something about the cover. You're an angel. Thank you. Oh, that's much better. Okay. Let me just say something about the cover. This is a beautiful painting by Michelle Ramirez, and no one's really asked me about the cover, but, you know, who this figure is on the cover is actually I identify with this figure on the cover. This is me. I mean, so as soon as I saw this painting, I thought it was really beautiful, and I identified with. I'm not female. I don't wear jeans like this, you know. But I identified immediately with this sort of isolated, watching twilight come, you know, meditative, low, you know. So it's basically I think of it as me, you know. And I figured I would read a few that I don't think I've ever read before from here. So this first one is, as Dave and I were you know, putting this book together, he's my editor, we were trying to figure out a title for it, and we couldn't think of one. We were kind of batting back and forth different poems in the book that might be the title poem. And at one point he said, well, just whatever you do, don't call it Postmortem. You know, because I think he thought nobody would buy a book that was called Postmortem, you know, and he was probably right about that. So we didn't, but I still like the poem. You ask me if writing poems is like dying. I only know when I write about anything that happened even 5 minutes ago. I feel I am writing about someone departed. I have forgotten things and only remembered them by reading an old draft in a notebook. Yes, I think That did happen. It's like Pancho Villa, who changed his name and went on the run, growing secret friends in every village like flowers of flesh, ready to shed his own life again and again for glory's sake. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so I used to have this habit of like collecting like stray people, mostly guys, like on the street. Like I would start talking to them, especially if they seemed like really down and out or, you know, skid row-ish. You know, I was just fascinated by that. Sometimes I would even bring them home. And most of the time, you know, a few times it was something wonderful. One time it was something really scary. Most of the time it was nothing. But then there were some interesting conversations, too, that came out of it. Because, you know, most people are if you pay them a little bit of attention, they'll talk to you about themselves. They've been yearning to do that, I found. So this is about a kid who was trying to sell a copy of the Gita. He was living with some Hare Krishnas. He was like a runaway. He's living with some Hare Krishnas. And this is what we talked about. Like word for word, I really didn't. It's called Next Year in the Garden. People need to be saved from themselves, a young panhandler tells me on Smithfield and 4th Street, urging me to buy his paperback Gita for a $5 tithe to the temple where he lives. He says I look friendly. The December air brings out such brightness in his brown eyes. I wish it was as friends that we were talking. And what if I gave it all up to sit full lotus at his altar piece? What then? Only the hope of sex could convince me to renounce sex. Only earthly love could convert me to some religion. I am obsessed with this world of tattooed skin and scruffy hair, this world building... this world boiling its steady 98 degrees, even as I hold myself in the long sleeves of my winter coat, though this world also wounds me with explosions and goodbyes. What's hurt him at a young age to make a life of abstinence and meditating the answer? People are animals, he says. Only now they run around on four wheels. He waves his big calloused hand at the traffic, calloused from what forced piecework. And for a moment, I see the world as he does, everyone working the asphalt hard, driving it home, drunken reeling mullets, horns, and hoofbeats, a real stampede. And here is this stranger with my dollar in his pocket, his hands folding like kissing doves as I walk away with neither Buddha nor sex, with only my skeptical heart squinting at the sunless sky. Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to get applauded for trying to pick up a stranger on the street. I don't think that's ever happened to me before. Okay, so this poem is called Cane Blues. And again, this is like really, it's almost verbatim something that happened. But I changed the name of the guy in it because, I just did. But I wanted, you know, the action of the poem is kind of gritty and streetwise. But I wanted to give the guy a name that was kind of like preppy and elite, so that it would kind of throw people off. So his name is Jeff in the poem, but it has nothing to do with anybody named Jeff. So One gibbous June night, I waited for Jeff under dogwoods by the gates of a mansion on Fifth Avenue. The people inside, he told me, are paranoid as hell. They don't like to meet anyone new. He took the cigarettes. I couldn't even trick the hour along by smoking. So I crouched in the black grass and sang the whole A-side of Sticky Fingers right up to the crazy, unhummable horn break on Can't You Hear Me Knocking, that flit and falsetto of bats in the treetops, every fit of headlights fading me deeper in my shadows. Still, I wouldn't have called the moment dangerous. That wouldn't have been the first word that came to mind. My demented midnight cabaret, with eyes half open like a sentry, dreaming of rescue on his watch. Then Jeff appeared with his stoned, scorded grin. We went back to his apartment. Years after I quit, a five-alarm fire gutted the mansion. What kind of rescue comes and goes? It stood alone for years, an abandoned hermit crab's husk, clapboards like blacked eyes, those mysterious tenants forced out long ago into the world they feared so much after disaster's endless courtship. And I never walk past it without remembering Jeff, someone's husband somewhere. Now I would call it dangerous, that life surrounding me with its smoky heat, its scattered promises, how off kilter, how off key. So, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, so that mansion was really weird. I had like I had that experience with it where I felt like, you know, and then like, I don't know, like a year later, I think I was taken there by someone else, and it just seemed to me like a kind of big crash pad, you know, like kind of like what I don't know if you watch Breaking Bad, but like when Jesse turns his parents' house into a big kind of flop house for all the meth heads, it just seemed like kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like a kid's hangout, and then it burned down and it became really sinister and scary, and it was like, oh my God. So I've never really known what to make of that house, and it seemed like a good metaphor for uncertain, like the indeterminacy of life, you know. All right, I'm actually going to read a poem that I hadn't planned to read. It just kind of popped into my head. This is probably the poem where I cop the most to my lifelong conflicted relationships and feelings about women, because I identify strongly with women. I like women, not in a sexual way, but I also feel very excluded in some ways, you know, like I can't really be, like I've never really been as a gay man totally accepted by them, you know, and so it's created these conflicts. This poem actually doesn't, I never really knew that it did this until recently, and yeah, I guess I'm just like a closet drag queen that wants to get knocked up by some stud or something. You'll see what I mean after I read it. It'll make more sense then. It's called Once in a Lifetime. Waves are swamping my desk. Cynthia's back from maternity leave, showing off her new baby. The office swims with goo-goo chat. All around me, the women chitter and twitter while a song on my radio takes me back to stoned college parties, a dance hit about drowning. 10 years deeper into debt and this hectic job, a few friends dead. I almost cringe to hear it. Am I being dragged into the hereafter? How can I tell them I once held a moonlit hand, once whirled among the dancers, those frayed ends never wove together, never led anywhere. Anyway, they never ask. Cynthia talks about her labor only with the women who have also given birth. Yes, this song is my only contribution, their conversation slicing through its lyrics like a DJ's remix, splicing in the world like a baby stumbling through his first lessons in how to take a fall, how to stand again. Given a choice, I'd say keep crawling close to the ground through this onion skin papoose of a world.
Thank you.
And I think I'm going to close now with this. My pants are falling down. I really don't want that to happen up here in front of y'all. one of the things that I'm proudest of having accomplished was this was in 2006. APR, American Poetry Review, took a bunch of translations that I had done of Jean Sénac, who was half Algerian, half French, wrote in French, put him on the cover, that's him. And I've never read these anywhere, but I just thought it might be nice to read a little bit from this. I was aced out of being part of the book that was published by a very senior member of the gay mafia who had dibs on it, you know. He didn't want to work with me. I sent him all these emails saying I'm doing Sénac too, you know. Can we maybe combine forces, you know? And he was like, no, you know. So, but you know, I mean, hey, it happens. I'm sure if I ever get to be a senior member of the gay mafia, I'll probably act exactly the same way. Maybe not. Okay, this is called November Ordeal. I left the cafes, tribunal, and palavers. I passed through an acid cloud. On my way toward those aisles where serpents unwind, nerves, verbs that can only be conjugated to die. Maybe the hour for living has come, as if we were no longer glittering sleigh bells, jingle-jangle treasures up to our necks in death. Maybe the hour has come for saying something pleasant, some saliva on the wound, silent as a pebble at work in the desert. I've left all my brothers so I could keep on believing in brotherhood, to build, even on mud, a house without prey, and its windows overlooking the stars. You will come back armed with my body, with every sound affirming the bled syllable. I will be the visible ray whose red carpet welcome your dim centuries have rolled out. In my acid cloud, I make my way toward you. This earth is mine with its bitter liturgy, its shit-smeared lights, its murderous roads, the topsy-turvy soul, the exhausted people. Mine with its sun cracking like an ice flow, the starved maze where our muscles grow lost, and all this vanity sprouting like wild herbs wherever the little kings fall to dreaming. With its insolent lineage, its air-conditioned corpses, its tanks and the rank sweat of the poem at the mercy of every safety lock. At the hour of mockery, I scream at the top of my lungs, a wing alighting, a smile I could live in, a hardened leg where a road begins. I won't go mountain climbing the myth. I know it's thistles, it's broomsticks, it's torpor, but always in the rock, wriggling into space, a secret snail and such an angry thumbnail. This earth is mine between two auspicious flights, two mass graves, two desires, two wet cement dreams, and in my veins a flute song routs Boab Dil's evil below pomegranate walls. Mine beyond reason, beyond the changing of your seasons, gnaw away, but on such a tender science, such a stubborn joy, chaos won't get hung up. In the space of the word, from your soul to your lips, from your laugh to my wound, a thousand colors rise up. From deluges of x-rays, I swim in the dazzle, for the first time a citizen of my own life. Thank you very much.